Thank you all for attending session 333, titled Truth, Beauty, and Goodness, a Way to Bridge Differences Between Mormons and Former Mormons. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging in the Q&A portion of the session following the remarks of the presenter. Those who cannot abide by those guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. This session is being recorded and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Take advantage of our symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine, 7 issues for the price of 6, at the registration desk as well. Consider also purchasing Skullcandy official headphones customized just for Sunstone. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after the session you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin preparation for the next session. When people leave the Mormon Church, tensions can rise up between them and their still faithful families and friends. By turning to the ancient idea of truth, beauty, and goodness, we can find a way to close the gap between believers and non-believers, diminishing these tensions and replacing them with love. Presenter will speak. John Ogden is the author of When Mormons Doubt, A Way to Save Relationships and Seek a Quality Life. He has a BA in English Literature and an MA in Rhetoric and Composition, both from BYU.
Thanks for coming, everybody. I'm really excited about the next hour, and I hope it can be a transformative experience and that we can all experience something good together. So, as you see, we're going to talk about truth, beauty, and goodness, and I'd like to start with a story. A story about a guy named Ted Leonsis. And Ted is a business tycoon. When he was in his early 20s, he became a millionaire. And he decided that he was going to spend his money on self-comforts. He bought houses, he bought cars, he tried to impress girls, and he was kind of in it to wow the world. Then he unexpectedly faced death. He boarded a plane, and kind of mid-flight, something malfunctioned, and nothing seemed right, and the pilot came on, and he said, hey, we're going to have to do an emergency landing, and the other passengers started crying, and he started worrying, like, oh my goodness, where do I turn? What do I do? He decided that his only option was to pray. So he said he turned to his higher calling and he said, if I make it through this, I promise I'm going to give my life. I'm going to leave more than I take and live for something more than myself. Luckily, the pilot got control of the plane and they landed safely. But the experience really shook him. And so the next weekend, he sat down and he wrote a list of 101 things that he wanted to do with his life before he died. And they consisted of things like helping my mother and father, taking care of my kids, those kind of things. This is a story that is universal. You might have heard it before, the same archetype. Ebenezer Scrooge, right, is another archetype of this. When he had a vision of his own funeral and saw that nobody cared that he died, he woke up to the realization that his life was kind of meaningless. And he remembered that remembering that we will all die can wake us up to this reality. The New York Times columnist, David Brooks, came up with this idea of resume virtues and eulogy virtues. And he said that in contemporary society, we're kind of overly focused on resume virtues. This will look good on a resume, right? To say things like, I graduated top of the class, I managed a team of 20 people. But he said that those aren't necessarily the virtues that people talk about at your eulogy, right? So he says that by focusing a little bit more on the eulogy virtues, we can head toward living a quality life. So the basic premise here is that Mormons and former Mormons can find common ground in the pursuit of a quality life. Now, that sounds nice, but it's pretty vague. And so during this presentation, we're going to move from abstraction to concrete examples, all right? But the basic idea is that we're both, no matter what we believe, we're trying to find a quality life, something that, again, if we go back to this quote from Taliansis, says, if I had to write my obituary, how would I keep score? So kind of starting with that frame of mind, think about that question for yourself. How would you keep score? What would you want people to say at your funeral? It brings up this question, how to live, right? So if you and all your loved ones are Orthodox Mormons, it's kind of cut out for you, right? You kind of know, okay, so I need to follow these commandments. I need to, if I'm male, I'm ordained to the priesthood, I serve a mission, you know, and similar things for females in terms of getting married in the temple, and you kind of have these milestones laid out. This is what I need to do to live a quality life. But what happens if somebody you love leaves? Do you automatically write them off as a failure, saying, okay, well, now they can't be successful because they've decided to leave? Or what if they're just unorthodox? This is a question that came up to me as I served a mission a little more than a decade ago. I found a lot of things on my mission that were deeply troubling, and I wrestled with a lot of I wrestled with doubts. I remember I wrote a letter to my dad expressing my anxiety. I wrote a letter to a former high school teacher who was non-Mormon, and I said, hey, I don't know if I can do this. My dad responded with this book of answers to hard Mormon questions, and my high school teacher wrote back and said, hey, you committed to serve, and you need to serve, and when you get back, you can wrestle with the doubts. That was kind of enough to alleviate my concerns, and I came back and went to BYU, and everything seemed fine. You know, I focused on dating, I focused on schoolwork, but then my sister, younger sister, ended up leaving the church. She had studied world religions, and she found some things that were unpalatable to her about religion, and she decided to leave. And my best friend from high school also left. And they weren't leaving because they were rebellious. They weren't leaving because they didn't want to keep the commandments anymore. They were leaving because they found hard things about the truth claims. And this caused me to kind of dive back into that world. And it's a hard thing. I'm sure many of us, if not all of us, have experienced it to some extent, that you suddenly find yourself in unorthodoxy and you're not quite sure where you fit. But the main question that kept surfacing for me is, how do I live? Right? It's no longer so cut and dry, where I can't necessarily say that if only all the world could follow all the Mormon milestones, we'd all live a quality life. It's not quite so simple. So I had to face many questions, including how do I save my relationships with those I loved, even though we have divergent views about Mormonism? How do I live a quality life in unorthodoxy? And how do I move upward through doubt? Occasionally I would see, at least from my perspective, some people get involved in doubt, and they didn't seem to be more at peace or to have moved upward. That's something we can talk about a little bit later. And then finally, how do I raise well-adjusted children in unorthodoxy? These are some of the questions that I wrestled with. And I'm going to present one way that has helped me. There are many different answers, and here's one that I find useful. And the answer is about truth, beauty, and goodness. So this is an ancient idea surfaced with Socrates and Plato and Plotinus, ancient philosophers, and it kind of went out of vogue in the Middle Ages, and it surfaced again in the 15th century with a scholar, Italian scholar named Marsilio Ficino. And it's surfaced again in more contemporary times with Albert Einstein. Einstein said, "The ideals which have lighted me on my way, and time after time given me new courage to face life cheerfully, have been truth, beauty, and goodness." And E.B. Du Bois said that public education should point students toward truth, beauty, and goodness instead of mere material gain. This was a theme in his book, The Souls of Black Folk. And Bertrand Russell talked about it as well. I'll circle back to him at the very end. But truth, beauty, and goodness are still pretty abstract, right? Like, we can all agree, sure, truth, beauty, and goodness. Yeah, they sound fine. So let's bring it down to earth. And one way to look at it is through a method that Stephen Covey, a Utah native, right, came up with in his book, The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. And he talked about these three ideas: intellectual exercise, spiritual exercise, and social exercise. So intellectual exercise we get by learning, reading, writing, and teaching. Spiritual exercise, spending time in nature, expanding spiritual self through meditation, music, and art. And social exercise is making social and meaningful connections with others. And I would add sacrifice and service in there as well. So I would equate this to truth, beauty, and goodness. This is how I would define the terms. Intellectual exercise leads us closer to truth. Let's walk through each of these. The hard part with truth, the pursuit of truth, is that it's often uncomfortable, right? When I was in grade school, in fifth grade, I learned how babies were made. And it happened in music class. A student turned to me, totally out of the blue, and asked me if I knew how it worked. I was like, yeah, of course I know how it worked. You have to be married, and then you kiss. And he laughed at me, and he's like, no, that's not how it works. And then he told me how it works, and I knew that was right. But then he proceeded to tell all the other kids in the class what I'd said. And they all laughed at me. Ha, you get married, and then you kiss. Oh, my gosh, John, you're an idiot, right? The terrors of grade school. I was wrong, and it was uncomfortable. I found the truth about how it worked. And something similar happened about a decade later when I was on my mission. My companion and I were tracking one night, and we could hear some college students through an open window up above us, and they were laughing about the Mormons. And so we sat and listened for a while and heard what they said, and we did the only thing we could think of to do, which was to go and knock on the door. And when the young man opened the door, the college student, his eyes went wide, and he kind of did a double take. It was almost as though, if you speak bad of us, we're going to show up, we're going to get you. And so they invited us in, and they said, we just watched an episode of South Park. And we're like, okay. And they said it was all about Joseph Smith. And they wanted to know how much it was true. And they asked us specifically, so in this cartoon, he looks into a hat. And, you know, I kind of, like, okay, here we go. You clearly can't trust everything you hear on Comedy Central. He didn't look into a hat. He translated it with the plates, right? And I'm trying to set the record straight. It turns out that they didn't want to hear any more of the discussions, but my companion and I left feeling good that we had set things straight and that we'd cleared up the record. So imagine my embarrassment when I later learned, actually, right? He translated it by looking into a hat. The search for truth is often uncomfortable, right? And that's something that doesn't jive quite well with our Mormon teaching a lot of times. A lot of times we say, the way that you know what is true is you'll feel peace. It's not always the case, right? Sometimes you learn things and it's like, that's not right, that's not right, that's not right. Wait, okay, that's right, I guess. And you have to accept it, right? So that's the pursuit of truth. Spiritual exercise leads us closer to beauty. Now, beauty is hard to define. It's an experience, it's feelings, it's mystical. The poet William Wordsworth called it a calm so deep. And the professor Wayne Booth, who is Mormon, he called the experience of beauty temporary blissful centerings. And at the end of his life, he wrote a list of the times when he had experienced these temporary blissful centerings. And I love to share this list every chance I get because it's changed my life dramatically. As I read it, think about the end of your life and what sorts of things would you include on a similar list? What are your temporary blissful centerings? So he lists loving my lifelong partner, cuddling a newborn child or grandchild, playing games with children, with friends, with anybody who is fully engaged with the game, listening to powerful music, playing music, the supreme bliss. Reading any novel or poem slowly, deliciously, totally absorbed. Writing a draft of something that feels good. Working many hours with marvelously collegial friends. Teaching a class when the discussion goes right. Looking at a flower or a shimmering lake or a magnified photo of an insect or a rainbow flash from a prism, feeling a flood of gratitude. Lighting a well-laid fire, staring at the flames as they mount. Attending Catholic Mass in a tiny chapel in France, singing the hymns, reveling in the deeply probing sermons by the priest who has welcomed us even though he knows that we are Mormons. Meditating silently in a Quaker meeting, surrounded by friends who interrupt only infrequently to report what their spirit dictates. Attending the Bat and Bart mitzvahs of my grandchildren, Emily and Aaron. Total spiritual elevation or religious ecstasy. Singing the Mormon hymn, Come, Come, Ye Saints, at my missionary homecoming service. These are beautiful moments in an everyday sense. And we can experience them, and we should experience them more often. When they occur in a more profound sense, they can constitute a powerful spiritual experience. These experiences happen all over the world, regardless of our belief or disbelief in religion, as long as we open ourselves to them and are willing to experience beauty. Finally, goodness. So social exercise leads us to goodness, and there's a lot that Mormonism does exceptionally well in terms of community. There's a lot to take and learn from Mormonism on this front in terms of organization and structure. I think of a story from Clayton Christensen, a Harvard business professor who was a bishop, and one day he visited a widow in his ward, and right when he stepped in the door, he smelled something horrible. And he couldn't figure out where it was for quite some time, and he eventually located it in a defunct fridge in the cellar, and it was some rotted grapefruits that were just swelling in the summer heat. And so he called a non-Mormon friend who lived nearby. He said, "Hey, can you come help me lift this fridge up and out of the house?" And the non-Mormon friend came, and as they're struggling to lift the fridge up, they kind of stop on a step and regain their breath, and the friend says, "You know what? I don't know very much about Mormonism. What can you tell me about it?" And Christensen kind of looked at the situation and he said, "This is about it." And obviously that's a simplification, but I like the impulse of that idea, that this is central to what he saw as the essential root of religion. It's about pure religion, right? Helping the fatherless and the widows in their affliction and being with the sick. This is goodness. So that kind of gives a view of these three ideas. But the trick lies in finding the proper balance or the blend of the three. And this is where it gets difficult. We all have a tendency or an impulse to lean one way or another. Some of us might be more inclined to intellectual exercise. Some of us might be more inclined to spiritual exercise. And some of us might be more inclined to social exercise. But sometimes we can pursue one of these with such a myopic view that we neglect the other two. And when that happens, we lose sight of living a quality life. So the quality life kind of sits in the center of these three. And let's look at what happens, what that looks like when we go out of balance. So pursuing truth without beauty makes us cynical. And this is a story of, let's say, someone who finds a lot of really uncomfortable facts about Mormon history, and they kind of dive down the rabbit hole of just looking at those facts over and over and over. And they might lose hold of what once brought them inner peace. So maybe they used to say prayers, or maybe they used to sing hymns, or read devotional texts. And in the pursuit of truth, they lose sight of those things, when in reality, they should try to find a way to complement the two. the pursuit of truth while still nurturing their spiritual health. Sometimes the pursuit of truth without goodness makes us lonely. This is the story of Stephen Dedalus, who's the character in the novel Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man in Ulysses. And in this story, he's born as an Irish Catholic. He realizes that his country and his religion are deeply flawed. And so he decides that he's going to strike out on his own, away from those deeply flawed institutions. And so he does. And a little while later, his mom is on her deathbed, and she asks him to pray for him, or pray for her. And he refuses, because he's committed to his truth. He's not going to budge on that. And she ends up dying without him praying for her. And later on in the book, he's filled with this regret. He realizes, why couldn't I have compromised? Why couldn't I have just been good in that instance? And that lives with him since that time. So truth without goodness makes us lonely when we remove ourselves completely from our community and are unwilling to compromise at all. Now, pursuing beauty without truth makes us gullible. This one is particularly frightening to me because it's what happens when you get in a group that has all these spiritual experiences and they don't check them against reason. This is like cult behavior. The story of Jonestown. So here's a quote from somebody who is in Jonestown. And they said, "I have never been so totally happy or fulfilled in my life. I can't begin to describe it. You could sit here and talk all day long and no words could describe the peace, the beauty, the sense of accomplishment and responsibility and camaraderie that's here. It's overwhelming. It really is. You can't describe it." This is part of what drew people into this, to Jonestown and the group led by Jim Jones, where they were taken in by his charisma and the beauty of the experiences they were having, but they weren't checking it. They weren't thinking, this is strange. He's doing some things that are very odd and very unscientific, and he's also doing things that are potentially very corrupt. And this is where we get the story of drinking the Kool-Aid, where one day over 900 of them all drank the Kool-Aid in anticipation, or they did it as an act of revolutionary suicide. So in our pursuit of spiritual experiences, we do have to check it with reason. Otherwise, it can end tragically. Then pursuing beauty without goodness can just make us selfish. This is when self-care turns self-centered. So sometimes you'll hear, increasingly I hear people saying, oh, I just need a little self-care. I just need some time for myself. And they'll go and have these experiences. But unchecked, it can just turn into selfishness, where you lose sight of responsibility and caring for other people, right? So that needs to also be kept in check. Finally, let's look at goodness. And then I want to break into discussion to actually talk about these ideas. Pursuing goodness without beauty is exhausting. Mormons, I think, are well acquainted with this. This is when you are doing the checklist, but you have no passion behind it, right? You're going and you're visiting people in their homes, but it's just dead, right? There's no love or no emotion. It's so routine and bland. It's colorless, right? When you have goodness without beauty. And then finally, pursuing goodness without truth is misdirected. Sometimes people will say that the only way to be good is to follow the prophets. And so they're pursuing goodness, but they're not willing to check it against truth. This happens, for instance, when people in the church claimed that skin color was caused by a curse from God, right? people believed that was true because they wanted to be good according to their paradigm. But they didn't know about melanin or skin pigmentation. They didn't know the science behind it. And when we learned the science behind it, some people still clasped that so tightly. They couldn't let go of that idea because they were trying to be good when they weren't willing to check it with science. The same thing happens with homosexuality, right? Where people are trying so desperately to be good, and they have these notions that it's something to be cured of. That's the paradigm that they have. And they think that that's the way to be good, is to believe those things. And they say it's unnatural, but they don't look at the science behind it to say, well, look, it's in nature, right? So that's the pursuit of goodness without looking at the truth claims more rigorously. So here we see again, it's possible for any of us, and with our natural inclinations, to kind of get off balance, to be so focused on one of these that we end up going astray in terms of living a quality life, in terms of writing an obituary that we would really want. So I want to break into discussion. I'd like you to talk to somebody that you're sitting next to, and let's talk about two things. One is the fact that we're all flawed in all of these ways, truth, beauty, and goodness, and we all have strengths in all of these. And the institutions that all of us belong to also have truth, beauty, and goodness, and they also fall short when it comes to truth, beauty, and goodness. The only way that we can rectify the problem is to be aware of it and then look at what we can do to refine it. So let's talk about, first, where do you feel that you have a natural leaning toward? And then where do you feel like you might be able to reflect on and say, maybe I do need a little bit more spiritual exercise, for instance. Maybe I do need a little bit more social exercise. In unorthodoxy, I've kind of let go of visiting the sick and the afflicted. And then we'll move into the institution. So let's break into groups of two and just kind of talk about this idea. Yeah. All right, let's go for another 2 minutes. Thank you. All right, let's come back together. All right, so let's go ahead and talk about what we found as a group. I need the bells, Thomas bells. All right, so what did we find?
Countdown
Five? Five, four, three, two, one. All right. Well, I'm excited because people seem energetic. That's a good sign that maybe something struck a chord, or maybe you're just sitting next to good friends. But that's exciting to me. So, I mean, maybe the question was a little bit... Well, it was personal, but I'm interested in what you find. Specifically, I'm interested in how we can, obviously, as I say in the subtitle of this presentation, how can we use these ideas to kind of bridge the differences that we see? Sometimes we can get so fixated on focusing on the truth claims, and we get in constant arguments with people about the truth claims. Occasionally, it's okay to take the foot off the gas there and say, hey, how about if we time out for a bit and focus on beauty and goodness, right? What did you talk about, though? What came up for you? Yeah, Nigel.
Well, I decided I'm low on goodness.
Okay.
I live in my head a lot.
Okay.
And I'm happy in my head. I'm an introvert.
Oh, do you want to start that over again? Sorry, so it can be recorded.
So, I fall short in the goodness area. I'm an introvert. I like living in my head. I find happiness living in my head. But I don't look out for other people and think about their needs and serving others, etc. So it was an excellent exercise. I haven't yet bridged to, okay, so how do I apply that to people who are pushing the truth claims of the church, and I sort of question them. I haven't taken it there, but it was a really valuable exercise. Thanks.
I'm glad to hear that. Thanks for sharing that, Nigel.
Like others in the room, I seek the sweet spot, the quality of life part. The challenge is when I'm with the group and we are slightly over the edge in either of the three directions. At what point do I, because I'm also weighing not making a scene. I don't want to disrupt the dynamic of the group. So I find myself over the boundary line, favoring truth, beauty, or goodness at various times, but outside of the sweet spot. And only when it migrates distantly from that sweet spot does my psyche tell me, hey, this is too far, you know. Call the group on it, you know, challenge them, bring them back to the middle ground. And where that critical boundary, where that margin is, the deviation from the sweet spot, is really what I struggle with. Because I don't want to be disruptive to someone who's nominally over the edge. You know, in metaphor, they're driving 56 miles an hour in a 55 speed limit. I'm not going to flag that. But what is the limit?
Right.
65, 70, 80.
I like that you said that your psyche, something comes up and says, hey, this is over, right? You kind of are feeling it in the moment, as I understand what you're saying. Lisa.
So I feel like truth is kind of my, like, zone of trust right now. Like, that's, like, where I'm comfortable currently. I think because before I was so in the beauty and goodness areas, and I kind of awoke while I was in that stage and found some truth that didn't align. So I think I lean heavier towards the pursuit of truth right now, and I loved thinking through, like, where's my beauty and goodness? That's such a good exercise for me right now. But I think speaking about, like, bridging, for me, it's really hard for me to bridge with myself and with my loved ones, where I have been seeking things like nature and meditation, and there's this non-denominational Christian church that's just so beautiful, my experiences that I have there. And those have been things in the last 6 months that that have brought beauty in my life. And then goodness, I've been looking for service outside of the church. But I feel like there's a discounting of those things, not just with me, but or not just with my loved ones, but within myself as well, because they don't have the LDS church stamp on them. And they, you know, they aren't what I grew up learning as those are the ways that you seek beauty and goodness. So I feel like in my own mind and in my loved ones' minds, it's a step down from what I was participating in before. And so I guess, like, it's kind of a question for the group and you, like, how do I overcome that? And how do I help my loved ones overcome this hierarchy of, you know, visiting teaching is greater than going and helping with backpacks for underprivileged children in third world countries? Like, yeah. how do we overcome that? It's a hard question, I think.
Yeah, that's a hard question. It is. Looks like there are lots of hands.
My question is, and I think other people feel this way, is that after leaving the church community, where we had lots of opportunities, in my case, to serve and feel like we were really helping people and kind of padding that eulogy resume where there were good things people would say about us, it's more difficult to find some of those opportunities when you don't have that community to serve in. Yeah. And I guess my question is suggestions that people have for how we can do that in a post-Mormon social situation or community?
A lot of great questions.
For that one, what he just said, one of the things that my daughter and I have discussed a lot while we're here at Sunstone, this is my first time here and just 3 months out of the church, is that I'm just flabbergasted sometimes by why people stay. There are certain reasons I understand. There are others I'm like, you can find that same thing somewhere else. It just takes a little more work. And that's the same with putting those good things into your life. They're there. They're out there. They're all over the place. You just have to look for them. And maybe you have to actually make some kind of chart or plan a monthly family service night or something like that. You can recreate the same things, the same structure that the church has in your own life independently. So it is more work, but it is certainly doable. As far as, I'm also really lucky in that I was the only member of my family who was Mormon. So for me to leave, they're all like, yay! So, it can be tricky. I still have friends who are LDS and attending, and so all I've found that I can do is the same thing that I did for the 10 years that I stayed at church with my doubts and my struggles, was that whenever I stayed to be a little champion for the LGBT community, and whenever someone would come out with one of those awful statements, I would raise my hand and I would say, for me, this is what I understand and what I know, and this is the science behind it, and this is what's been proven, and my experience with my children is X. So I think that sometimes, like, when you're trying to talk to your family, and it can be very fraughtful, I know, is just say, all I can say is that for me, volunteering to pack the backpacks is equal to visiting teaching in my life and the rewards that it brings to me.
That's great. One more comment, and then we'll move on.
So I like what people have said about, like Stephen mentioned, that we're trying to be centered on there. And that seems good as an individual effort, particularly. But in the context of what do we do to bridge differences between ourselves and family members, you know, that may have different beliefs, right. I like it that this gives us some commonalities. Even if we're not centered in the same way that our Mormon family and friends think that they're centered, it gives us commonality. So we can say, you know what, maybe we don't see eye to eye on what the truth is here,
right.
But we can talk about it in terms of beauty and goodness. Mm-hmm. And it gives us a language beyond where we disagree. And I think that's a great chart for finding commonalities.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, what I would hope is that people who feel uncomfortable with the truth claims would still feel comfortable in a situation or an event that is like a service project of the church. That they would be able to kind of separate the two and say, like, okay, I don't believe many of the foundational truth claims, so that's not going to prevent me from this service project. Or maybe a singing of the Hallelujah chorus as a choir. Some words do that. And you might have found that it was peaceful in your past. And you might say, you know, I still want that. So, yeah, I agree that hopefully this is helpful in terms of breaking it down and seeing, like, where can we find common ground? Can we find common ground in meditation, even if we disagree about the truth claims? Or maybe you all agree about the truth claims, and you have different ways of viewing goodness as well. And hopefully it can be helpful there. I'd like to turn back to comments at the end, but let's move on to part two, which is shorter. But it circles back to this idea of the funeral. And this is the foundation of truth, beauty, and goodness, and it's reverence. So in Mormonism, when we think of reverence, we might think of like the primary kid sitting at the front of the class with his arms folded, like the reverence child. We might equate reverence with quiet, being quiet. But reverence at its roots means something much different, and it comes from the Latin word reverentia, which means to stand in awe of something. And a contemporary scholar named Paul Woodruff wrote a book called Reverence, Renewing a Forgotten Virtue. Here's what he says about reverence. He says, reverence begins in a deep understanding of human limitations. From this grows the capacity to be in awe of whatever we believe lies outside our control. God, truth, justice, nature, even death. The capacity for awe, as it grows, brings with it the capacity for respecting fellow human beings, flaws and all. Everyone here knows that someday we're going to die, and that puts us all on the same field, regardless of our beliefs, right? How can I feel smug toward another human being when I am full of flaws? Right? That's the feeling that comes when you have reverence. That's what reverence is. It's this feeling of awe that at some level we're totally broken, and that is okay, and it means that I can respect you. He adds, reverence is not faith, because the faithful may hold their faith with arrogance and self-satisfaction, and because the reverent may not know what to believe. Reverence runs across religions and even outside them, through the fabric of any community, however secular. We may be divided from one another by our beliefs, but never by reverence. If you desire peace in the world, do not pray that everyone share your beliefs. Pray instead that all may be reverent. Wayne Booth, he's the guy who I quoted who had that long list of temporary blissful centerings, and he's a hero of mine. He grew up in American Fork in the 30s and 40s. And as he grew older, he did have severe doubts on the truth claims of Mormonism. He remained Mormon throughout his life, but he said he was Mormon according to his own definition, which I like. He was a scholar of rhetoric, and he was easily one of the most influential people in the field in the past 100 years. He wrote an article for Sunstone in the 80s where he talked about an important but admittedly ugly word that he coined to help people who disagree get along with each other. The word is rhetorology. Okay? So if you can get past the ugliness of the word, I promise that there's some utility here. So rhetorology is reverence and practice. So rhetoric comes from the Greek word for speaker, and as there was the rise of democracy, the Greeks realized that the way to have power in democracy is to learn how to be articulate and to make powerful arguments. And so they created the study of how to speak well. And the purpose there is to say, how can I persuade you to believe what I believe? That's what rhetoric aims at. And there's a lot of use for that. Rhetorology stands in opposition a little bit to that. It says, how can we understand each other? So it's the study of the speakers. That's the literal breakdown, speaker study of the speakers. And Wayne Booth said it was the probing of the deepest convictions underlying both sides in any conflict. So this is reverence and practice. And why I say that this is the foundation of truth, beauty, and goodness is because think of how you find truth. Do you find truth by saying, I'm going to convince you to believe what I believe? You find truth by saying, I don't know. Right? And opening yourself up to listening. Well, how do you find beauty? In my experience, many of the most beautiful moments of my life have come when I felt this deep understanding with somebody else. This powerful sense of connection where I'm just filled with love because I understand them. And then how do you find goodness? Again, it's not coming in with, you know, your fist out and saying, this is the way it's done. Saying, how do you see that it should be done? Maybe we can work together to figure out how to improve this. So this is the foundation of truth, beauty, and goodness. Starting from a place of reverence rather than a place of certainty. And rhetorology is how we put it into practice. So I'd like to close with some examples. Let's say that Marin and Ryan are a couple, and Marin has just found out some uncomfortable things about polygamy. She was raised, she believed that God loved her and that she was worthwhile, but then she finds out about Joseph Smith's wives. And she's reading the Doctrine and Covenants, and it says that woman shall be given unto men. In Doctrine and Covenants, what is that? I should have looked at 132, right? And these things deeply trouble her. So she comes to Ryan, and she expresses these things, and he shuts her down. He says, you shouldn't be looking at those things. And she says, well, I've been looking at them on the church's sites. I haven't been looking at anti-Mormon material. And he says that what she needs to do is just focus on, go back to her testimony and the feelings that she had there. So rhetorology would say, rather than continuing to fight truth versus beauty, because that's where they're coming from, to say, okay, let's step back from this position and let's look at the study of both of our arguments and try to dissect what we have in common still. And so in the process of listing what they have in common, they realize that they really care about their children, they really care about serving in their community, they really care about their weekly walks in nature or walking in the evenings, and they hold on those things and kind of let the truth claims take an organic process. Rather than forcing it, does that make sense? Rather than forcing the point over and over and over, because that can create greater and greater divide over time. Which isn't to say ignore the truth claims by any stretch. It's to say the moment that you step into truth and you feel that discomfort, you might need to balance it with something like beauty and goodness and come back to truth and come back to beauty and goodness, right? And that's a more organic process than forcing truth forcing that point over and over again. I don't think I needed to belabor the point with David and Brad. I hope that you get the idea of rhetorology. Rhetorology is where you can step back and say, okay, look, here's what I believe, and here's what I hear you saying that you believe. Is that right? And if they can say yes, then you've reached a point of understanding. And from that place of love, you can keep the relationship alive and even move upward as you together find more truth, beauty, and goodness. So, rhetorology is putting reverence into practice. It asks, can you admit the trade-offs to your position? Can you list what you have in common? Can you say how the other person feels in a way that they would find acceptable? This is reverence in practice, and this is how you find truth, beauty, and goodness. I'd like to conclude by reading an excerpt from Bertrand Russell. Like Wayne Booth, he wrote something at the end of his life as he looked back. And this is very powerful to me because it again calls me back to this idea of eulogy virtues. What is our life about, and how can we live a quality life? He says that three passions, simple but overwhelmingly strong, have governed my life: the longing for love, the search for knowledge, and unbearable pity for the suffering of mankind. I see some resemblance to truth, beauty, and goodness here, right? The longing for love, I might say, is beauty. The search for knowledge, truth, and unbearable pity would be goodness. Rather, it would be acting on the unbearable pity, but I'll let Bertrand slide. He says, these passions, like great winds, have blown me hither and thither in a wayward course over a great ocean of anguish, reaching to the very verge of despair. I have sought love first because it brings ecstasy so great that I would often have sacrificed all the rest of life for a few hours of this joy. I have sought it next because it relieves loneliness, that terrible loneliness in which one shivering consciousness looks over the rim of the world into the cold, unfathomable, lifeless abyss. I have sought it finally because in the union of love, I have seen in a mystic miniature the prefiguring vision of heaven that saints and poets have imagined. This is what I have sought, and though it might seem too good for human life, this is what, at last, I have found. With equal passion, I have sought knowledge. I have wished to understand the hearts of men. I have wished to know why the stars shine. And I have tried to apprehend the Pythagorean power by which number holds sway above the flux. A little of this, but not much, I have achieved. Love and knowledge, so far as they were possible, led me upward toward the heavens, but always pity brought me back to earth. Echoes of cries of pain reverberate in my heart. Children in famine, victims tortured by oppressors, helpless old people, a burden to their sons, and the whole world of loneliness, poverty, and pain make a mockery of what human life should be. I long to alleviate this evil, but I cannot, and I too suffer. This has been my life. I have found it worth living and would gladly live it again if the chance were offered me. I hope that all of us can say the same at the end of our lives. Thank you.
We do have about 5 minutes remaining in the session for questions, if anybody has some. If not, we can end the session early. Depends on you guys. Questions, comments?
So when we're pursuing the balance of these three things, how do we make that fit within ourselves, within our core selves, when other people don't? So I guess that's my question.
Yeah, it's a great question. So none of us are going to resonate completely with any other person, and so that's a great place to start from, to acknowledge that total union is impossible. And if we can start from there, then we can start forgiving some of the gaps that we have. But I would hope that what people might be able to see is that where you're having contention, and if it continues and it builds and builds and builds and the divisiveness just grows and grows, that might be a sign that you need to focus on another thing. That you need to say, okay, let's circle back to that. But for now, let's just focus on nurturing beauty in our lives. We'll come back to the truth, right? But let's breathe for a little bit, right? Again, acknowledging that you're never going to agree completely. And that's part of what makes, that's actually a very positive thing, because as I said, we all have a natural inclination towards somewhere on that map. And that's what makes for a positive community, is that we have a communal blend of natural inclinations. And so the whole is greater than the sum, right? Or that phrase goes.
John, first I just want to acknowledge you for somebody who truly cares about bridging gaps in the Mormon and post-Mormon world. Your blogs are extremely articulate, and knowing you, you're not going to push your book. So I just wanted to let everyone know, yeah, or this gentleman in front of me who has a copy. I just have it on my Kindle. But he just released this book, and I think it would be incorrect for people not to know that. So I think that you're making a big difference, and I just want to applaud you.
Oh, thank you so much. That's very nice.
John, just one quick question. Unconditional mutual respect, how's that different from reverence? Or could it be pretty much the same thing?
It's pretty much the same thing. The difference is that reverence is in relation to something up above. Like, death is bigger than any of us. And because of that, we are in awe. And therefore, we have respect horizontally. Does that make sense? So respect is more like me and you. And reverence is, there's something greater. Therefore, I'm going to respect you. So, yeah.
Thanks. I just wanted to add on to what Steve had already said about your book. I heard a rumor walking in here that you might be doing a book signing today. Can you confirm that for us? Let us know when that will be and where that will be.
Yeah, I don't know who set it up, but somebody set it up.
Emma.
That was so nice of her.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Right now, like in a few minutes.
Okay. Out here or in here?
Out there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you.
Okay, yeah.
Thanks, John.
Uh-huh.
I just wanted to say what you're talking about, that reverence, to me sounds like reverence for the sanctity of life. And that can be seen as bigger than all of us. And it is also mutual respect for every human being, for every type of life in this world. And I come from a mediation background.
Hmm. And that's, you can't. That's the root principle.
Interesting.
You can't communicate. You can't work out differences, whether it's with family members, post-Mormon, current Mormon, whatever that divide is caused by. You can't ever get to real communication on any level, truth, goodness, beauty, any of it, if you don't originate from that respect for each other. It just can't happen.
Thanks for sharing that. Thank you all for coming. Much love. Have a great day.